trees to the maintenance building. That's where the power equipment and generators are. I believe you saw the maintenance building yesterday?
Yes, Grant said, though he was momentarily puzzled. Was it yesterday that he had looked into the building? It seemed like years ago.
Now listen, Wu said. We think we can get all the raptors down here by the lodge, but we aren't sure. So be careful. Give us 5 minutes.
Okay, Grant said.
You can leave the kids in the cafeteria, and they should be all right. Take the radio with you when you go.
Okay.
Turn it off before you leave so it doesn't make any noise outside, and call me when you get to the maintenance building.
Okay. Grant turned the radio off.
Lex crawled back.
Are we going to the cafeteria? She said.
Yes, Grant said. They got up and started walking through the blowing mist in the lobby.
I want a hamburger,
Lex said. I don't think there's any electricity to cook with.
Then ice cream.
Tim, you'll have to stay with her and help her.
I will.
I've got to leave for a while, Grant said.
I know.
They moved to the cafeteria entrance. On opening the door, Grant saw square dining room tables and chairs, swinging stainless steel doors beyond. Nearby, a cash register and a rack with gum and candy. Okay, kids, I want you to stay here no matter what. Got it?
Leave us the radio,
Lex said. I can't. I need it. Just stay here. I'll only be gone about 5 minutes, okay?
Okay.
Grant closed the door. The cafeteria became completely dark. Lex clutched his hand.
Turn on the lights, she said.
I can't, Tim said. There's no electricity.
But he pulled down his night vision goggles.
That's fine for you. What about me?
Just hold my hand. We'll get some food.
He led her forward. In phosphorescent green, he saw the tables and chairs. To the right, the glowing green cash register and the rack with gum and candy. He grabbed a handful of candy bars.
I told you, Lex said. I want ice cream, not candy.
Take these anyway.
Ice cream, Tim.
Okay, okay.
Tim stuffed the candy bars in his pocket and led Lex deeper into the dining room. She tugged on his hand.
I can't see spit, she said. Just walk with me. Hold my hand. Then slow down.
Beyond the tables and chairs was a pair of swinging doors with little round windows in them. They probably led to the kitchen. He pushed one door open, and it held wide. Ellie Sattler stepped outside the front door to the lodge and felt the chilly mist on her face and legs. Her heart was thumping, even though she knew she was completely safe behind the fence. Directly ahead, she saw the heavy bars in the fog. But she couldn't see much beyond the fence, another 20 yards before the landscape turned milky white. And she didn't see any raptors at all. In fact, the gardens and trees were almost eerily silent.
Hey!
She shouted into the fog, tentatively. Muldoon leaned against the doorframe.
I doubt that'll do it, he said. You got to make a noise.
He hobbled out carrying a steel rod from the construction inside. He banged the rod against the bars like a dinner gong.
Come and get it! Dinner is served!
Very amusing, Ellie said. She glanced nervously toward the roof. She saw no raptors.
They don't understand English, Muldoon grinned, but I imagine they get the general idea.
She was still nervous and found his humor annoying. She looked toward the visitor building cloaked in the fog. Muldoon resumed banging on the bars. At the limit of her vision, almost lost in the fog, she saw a ghostly pale animal. A raptor.
First customer, Muldoon said.
The raptor disappeared, a white shadow, and then came back, but it did not approach any closer, and it seemed strangely incurious about the noise coming from the lodge. She was starting to worry. Unless she could attract the raptors to the lodge, Grant would be in danger.
You're making too much noise,
Ellie said.
Bloody hell, Muldoon said.
Well, you are.
I know these animals.
You're drunk, she said. Let me handle it.
And how will you do that?
She didn't answer him. She went to the gate.
They say the raptors are intelligent.
They are, at least as intelligent as chimps.
They have good hearing?
Yes, excellent.
Maybe they'll know this sound, she said, and opened the gate.
The metal hinges, rusted from the constant mist, creaked loudly. She closed it again, opened it with another creak. She left it open.
I wouldn't do that, Muldoon said. You're going to do that? Let me get the launcher.
Get the launcher.
He sighed, remembering.
Gennaro has the shells.
Well then, she said, keep an eye out. And she went through the gate, stepping outside the bars. Her heart was pounding so hard she could barely feel her feet on the dirt. She moved away from the fence, and it disappeared frighteningly fast in the fog. Soon it was lost behind her. Just as she had expected, Muldoon began shouting to her in drunken agitation.
God damn it, girl! Don't you do that!
He bellowed. Don't call me girl, she shouted back.
I'll call you any damn thing I want, Muldoon shouted.
She wasn't listening. She was turning slowly, her body tense, watching from all sides. She was at least 20 yards from the fence now, and she could see the mist drifting like a light rain past the foliage. She stayed away from the foliage. She moved through a world of shades of gray. The muscles in her legs and shoulders ached from the tension. Her eyes strained to see.
Do you hear me, dammit?
Muldoon bellowed. How good are these animals, she wondered. Good enough to cut off my retreat? There wasn't much distance back to the fence, not really. They attacked. There was no sound. The first animal charged from the foliage at the base of a tree to the left. It sprang forward, and she turned to run. The second attacked from the other side, clearly intending to catch her as she ran, and it leapt into the air, claws raised to attack, and she darted like a broken field runner, and the animal crashed down in the dirt. Now she was running flat out, not daring to look back, her breath coming in deep gasps, seeing the bars of the fence emerge from the haze, seeing Muldoon throw the gate wide, seeing him reaching for her, shouting to her, grabbing her arm and pulling her through so hard she was yanked off her feet and fell to the ground, and she turned in time to see first one, then two, then three animals hit the fence and snarl.
Good work, Muldoon shouted.
He was taunting the animals now, snarling back. And it drove them wild. They flung themselves at the fence, leaping forward, and one of them nearly made it over the top.
Christ, that was close! These bastards can jump!
She got to her feet, looking at the scrapes and bruises, the blood running down her leg. All she could think was, three animals here and two on the roof. That meant one was still missing, somewhere.
Come on, help me, Muldoon said. Let's keep them interested!
Grant left the visitor center and moved quickly forward into the mist. He found the path among the palm trees and followed it north. Up ahead, the rectangular maintenance shed emerged from the fog. There was no door that he could see at all. He walked on around the corner. At the back, screened by planting, Grant saw a concrete loading dock for trucks. He scrambled up to face a vertical, rolling door of corrugated steel. It was locked. He jumped down again and continued around the building. Farther ahead to his right, Grant saw an ordinary door. It was propped open with a man's shoe. Grant stepped inside and squinted in the darkness. He listened. Heard nothing. He picked up his radio and turned it on. This is Grant, he said. I'm inside. Wu looked up at the skylight. The two raptors still peered down into Malcolm's room, but they seemed distracted by the noises outside. He went to the lodge window. Outside, the three velociraptors continued to charge the fence. Ellie was running back and forth safely behind the bars, but the raptors no longer seemed to be seriously trying to get her. Now they almost seemed to be playing, circling back from the fence, rearing up and snarling, then dropping down low to circle again and finally charge. Their behavior had taken on the distinct quality of display, rather than serious attack.
Like birds, Muldoon said, putting on a show.
Wu nodded. They're intelligent. They see they can't get her. They're not really trying. The radio crackled.
Side.
Wu gripped the radio.
Say again, Dr. Grant?
I'm inside, Grant said.
Dr. Grant, you're in the maintenance building?
Yes, Grant said, and he added, maybe you should call me Alan.
All right, Alan, if you're standing just inside the east door, you see a lot of pipes and tubing.
Wu closed his eyes, visualizing it.
Straight ahead is a big, recessed well in the center of the building that goes two stories underground. To your left is a metal walkway with railings.
I see it.
Go along the walkway.
I'm going.
Faintly, the radio carried the clang of his footsteps on metal.
After you go 20 or 30 feet, you will see another walkway going right.
I see it, Grant said.
Follow that walkway.
Okay.
As you continue, Wu said, you will come to a ladder on your left, going down into the pit. I see it. Go down the ladder.
There was a long pause. Wu ran his fingers through his damp hair. Muldoon frowned tensely.
Okay, I'm down the ladder, Grant said. Good, Wu said. Now, straight ahead of you should be two large yellow tanks that are marked flammable. They say inflammable, and then something underneath in Spanish. Those are the ones, Wu said. Those are the two fuel tanks for the generator. One of them has been run dry, and so we have to switch over to the other. If you look at the bottom of the tanks, you'll see a white pipe coming out.
4-inch PVC?
Yes, PVC. Follow that pipe as it goes back.
Okay, I'm following it.
Ow! What happened?
Nothing, I hit my head.
There was a pause.
Are you all right?
Yeah, fine, just hurt my head. Stupid.
Keep following the pipe.
Okay, okay,
Grant said. He sounded irritable.
Okay, the pipe goes to a big aluminum box with air vents in the sides. It says Honda. It looks like the generator.
Yes, Wu said, that's the generator. If you walk around to the side, you'll see a panel with two buttons.
I see them. Yellow and red?
That's right, Wu said. Press the yellow one first, and while you hold it down, press the red one.
Right.
There was another pause. It lasted almost a minute. Wu and Muldoon looked at each other.
Alan?
It didn't work, Grant said.
Did you hold down the yellow first and then press the red? Wu asked.
Yes, I did, Grant said. He sounded annoyed. I did exactly what you told me to do. There was a hum, and then a click, click, click very fast, and then the hum stopped, and nothing after that.
Try it again.
I already did, Grant said. It didn't work.
Okay, just a minute.
Wu frowned. It sounds like the generator is trying to fire up, but it can't for some reason.
Alan?
I'm here.
Go around to the back of the generator to where the plastic pipe runs in.
Okay.
A pause. Then Grant said,
the pipe goes into a round black cylinder that looks like a fuel pump.
That's right, Wu said. That's exactly what it is. It's the fuel pump. Look for a little valve at the top.
A valve?
It should be sticking up at the top with a little metal tab that you can turn.
I found it, but it's on the side, not the top.
Okay, twist it open.
Air is coming out.
Good, wait until...
Now liquid is coming out, it smells like gas.
Okay, close the valve.
Wu turned to Muldoon, shaking his head. Pump lost its prime.
Alan?
Yes?
Try the buttons again.
A moment later, Wu heard the faint coughing and sputtering as the generator turned over, and then the steady chugging sound as it caught.
It's on, Grant said.
Good work, Alan, good work.
Now what?
Grant said. He sounded flat, dull. The lights haven't even come on in here.
Go back to the control room, and I'll talk you through restoring the systems manually.
That's what I have to do now?
Yes.
Okay, Grant said. I'll call you when I get there.
There was a final hiss and silence.
Alan?
The radio was dead. Tim went through the swinging doors at the back of the dining room and entered the kitchen. A big stainless steel table in the center of the room, a big stove with lots of burners to the left, and beyond that, big walk-in refrigerators. Tim started opening the refrigerators, looking for ice cream. Smoke came out in the humid air as he opened each one.
How come the stove is on? Lex said, releasing his hand.
It's not on. They all have little blue flames.
Those are pilot lights. What are pilot lights?
They had an electric stove at home.
Never mind, Tim said, opening another refrigerator, but it means I can cook you something.
In this next refrigerator, he found all kinds of stuff. Cartons of milk and piles of vegetables and a stack of T-bone steaks. Fish.
You still want ice cream? I told you, didn't I?
The next refrigerator was huge. A stainless steel door with a wide horizontal handle. He tugged on the handle, pulled it open, and saw a walk-in freezer. It was a whole room, and it was freezing cold.
Timmy, will you wait a minute?
He said, annoyed. I'm trying to find your ice cream.
Timmy, something's here.
She was whispering. and for a moment the last two words didn't register. Then Tim hurried back out of the freezer, seeing the edge of the door wreathed in glowing green smoke. Lex stood by the steel work table. She was looking back to the kitchen door. He heard a low hissing sound, like a very large snake. The sound rose and fell softly. It was hardly audible. It might even be the wind. But he somehow knew it wasn't.
"Timmy," she whispered, "I'm scared."
He crept forward to the kitchen door and looked out. In the darkened dining room, he saw the orderly green rectangular pattern of the tabletops, and moving smoothly among them, silent as a ghost, except for the hissing of its breath, was a velociraptor. In the darkness of the maintenance room, Grant felt along the pipes, moving back toward the ladder. It was difficult to make his way in the dark, and somehow he found the noise of the generator disorienting. He came to the ladder, and it started back up, when he realized there was something else in the room besides generator noise. Grant paused, listening. It was a man shouting. It sounded like Gennaro.
"Where are you?" Grant shouted. "Over here," Gennaro said. "In the truck."
Grant couldn't see any truck. He squinted in the darkness. He looked out of the corner of his eye. He saw green, glowing shapes, moving in the darkness. Then he saw the truck, and he turned toward it. Tim found the silence chilling. The velociraptor was 6 feet tall and powerfully built, although its strong legs and tail were hidden by the tables. Tim could see only the muscular upper torso, the two forearms held tightly alongside the body, the claws dangling. He could see the iridescent speckled pattern on the back. The velociraptor was alert. As it came forward, it looked from side to side, moving its head with abrupt, bird-like jerks. The head also bobbed up and down as it walked, and a long, straight tail dipped, which heightened the impression of a bird. A gigantic, silent bird of prey. The dining room was dark, but apparently the raptor could see well enough to move steadily forward. From time to time it would bend over, lowering its head below the tables. Tim heard a rapid sniffing sound. Then the head would snap up, alertly, jerking back and forth like a bird's. Tim watched until he was sure the velociraptor was coming toward the kitchen. Was it following their scent? All the books said dinosaurs had a poor sense of smell, but this one seemed to do just fine. Anyway, what did books know? Here was the real thing. Coming toward him. He ducked back into the kitchen.
"Is something out there?" Lex said.
Tim didn't answer. He pushed her under a table in the corner behind a large waste bin. He leaned close to her and whispered fiercely, "Stay here!" And then he ran for the refrigerator. He grabbed a handful of cold steaks and hurried back to the door. He quietly placed the first of the steaks on the floor, then moved back a few steps and put down the second. Through his goggles, he saw Lex peeping around the bin. He waved her back. He placed the third steak and the fourth, moving deeper into the kitchen. The hissing was louder, and then the clawed hand gripped the door, and the big head peered cautiously around. The velociraptor paused at the entrance to the kitchen. Tim stood in a half-crouch at the back of the room near the far leg of the steel work table, but he had not had time to conceal himself. His head and shoulders still protruded over the tabletop. He was in clear view of the velociraptor. Slowly, Tim lowered his body, sinking beneath the table. The velociraptor jerked its head around, looking directly at Tim. Tim froze. He was still exposed, but he thought, "Don't move." The velociraptor stood motionless in the doorway, sniffing.
"It's darker here," Tim thought. "He can't see so well. It's making him cautious."
But now he could smell the musty odor of the big reptile, and through his goggles, he saw the dinosaur silently yawn, throwing back its long snout, exposing rows of razor-sharp teeth. The velociraptor stared forward again, jerking its head from side to side. The big eyes swiveled in the bony sockets. Tim felt his heart pounding. Somehow it was worse to be confronted by an animal like this in a kitchen instead of the open forest. The size, the quick movements, the pungent odor, the hissing breath. Up close, it was a much more frightening animal than the Tyrannosaur. The Tyrannosaur was huge and powerful, but it wasn't especially smart. The velociraptor was man-size, and it was clearly quick and intelligent. Tim feared the searching eyes, almost as much as the sharp teeth. The velociraptor sniffed. It stepped forward, moving directly toward Lex. It must smell her somehow. Tim's heart thumped. The velociraptor stopped. It bent over slowly.
He's found the steak.
Tim wanted to bend down to look below the table, but he didn't dare move. He stood frozen in a half-crouch, listening to the crunching sound. The dinosaur was eating it, bones and all. The raptor raised its slender head and looked around. It sniffed. It saw the second steak. It moved quickly forward. It bent down. Silence. The raptor didn't eat it. The head came back up. Tim's legs burned from the crouch, but he didn't move. Why hadn't the animal eaten the second steak? A dozen ideas flashed through his mind. It didn't like the taste of beef. It didn't like the coldness. It didn't like the fact that the meat wasn't alive. It smelled a trap. It smelled Lex. It smelled Tim. It saw Tim. The velociraptor moved very quickly now. It found the third steak, dipped its head, looked up again, and moved on. Tim held his breath. The dinosaur was now just a few feet from him. Tim could see the small twitches in the muscles of the flanks. He could see the crusted blood on the claws of the hand. He could see the fine pattern of striations within the spotted pattern, and the folds of skin in the neck below the jaw. The velociraptor sniffed. It jerked its head and looked right at Tim. Tim nearly gasped with fright. Tim's body was rigid, tense. He watched as the reptile eye moved, scanning the room. Another sniff. "He's got me," Tim thought. Then the head jerked back to look forward, and the animal went on toward the fifth stake. Tim thought, "Lex, please don't move. Please don't move. Whatever you do, please don't." The velociraptor sniffed the stake and moved on. It was now at the open door to the freezer. Tim could see the smoke billowing out, curling along the floor toward the animal's feet. One big clawed foot lifted, then came down again silently. The dinosaur hesitated.
"Too cold," Tim thought. "He won't go in there, it's too cold. He won't go in, he won't go in, he won't go in."
The dinosaur went in. The head disappeared, then the body, then the stiff tail. Tim sprinted, flinging his weight against the stainless steel door of the locker, slamming it shut. It slammed on the tip of the tail, the door wouldn't shut. The velociraptor roared, a terrifying loud sound. Inadvertently, Tim took a step back. The tail was gone. He slammed the door shut and heard it click. Closed!
"Lex! Lex!" he was screaming.
He heard the raptor pounding against the door, felt it thumping the steel. He knew there was a flat steel knob inside, and if the raptor hit that, it would knock the door open. They had to get the door locked.
"Lex!"
Lex was by his side.
"What do you want?"
Tim leaned against the horizontal door handle, holding it shut.
"There's a pin! A little pin! Get the pin!"
The velociraptor roared like a lion, the sound muffled by the thick steel. It crashed its whole body against the door.
"I can't see anything!"
Lex shouted. The pin was dangling beneath the door handle, swinging on a little metal chain.
"It's right there! I can't see it!"
she screamed. And then Tim realized she wasn't wearing the goggles.
"Feel for it!"
He saw her little hand reaching up, touching his, groping for the pin. And with her so close to him, he could feel how frightened she was, her breath in little panicky gasps as she felt for the pin. And the velociraptor slammed against the door, and it opened! God, it opened! But the animal hadn't expected that, and had already turned back for another try, and Tim slammed the door shut again. Lex scrambled back, reached up in the darkness.
"I have it!"
Lex cried, clutching the pin in her hand, and she pushed it through the hole. It slid out again.
"From the top! Put it in from the top!"
She held it again, lifting it on the chain, swinging it over the handle and down into the hole. Locked! The velociraptor roared. Tim and Lex stepped back from the door as the dinosaur slammed into it again. With each impact, the heavy steel wall hinges creaked, but they held. Tim didn't think the animal could possibly open the door. The raptor was locked in. He gave a long sigh.
"Let's go,"
he said. He took her hand, and they ran.
"You should have seen them," Gennaro said as Grant led him back out of the maintenance building. "There must have been 24 of them, compies. I had to crawl into the truck to get away from them. They were all over the windshield, just squatting there, waiting like buzzards. But they ran away when you came over." Scavengers, Grant said. They won't attack anything that's moving or looks strong. They attack things that are dead, or almost dead. Anyway, unmoving. They were going up the ladder now, back toward the entrance door. What happened to the raptor that attacked you? Grant said.
I don't know, Gennaro said. Did it leave? I didn't see. I got away, I think because it was injured. I think Muldoon shot it in the leg and it was bleeding while it was in here.
Then, I don't know, maybe it went back outside. Maybe it died in here, I didn't see.
And maybe it's still in here, Grant said.
Wu stared out the lodge window at the raptors beyond the fence. They still seemed playful, making mock attacks at Ellie. The behavior had continued for a long time now, and it occurred to him that it might be too long. It almost seemed as if they were trying to keep Ellie's attention, in the same way that she was trying to keep theirs. The behavior of the dinosaurs had always been a minor consideration for Wu, and rightly so. Behavior was a second-order effect of DNA, like protein enfolding. You couldn't really predict behavior, and you couldn't really control it, except in very crude ways, like making an animal dependent on a dietary substance by withholding an enzyme. But in general, behavioral effects were simply beyond the reach of understanding. You couldn't look at a DNA sequence and predict behavior. It was impossible. And that had made Wu's DNA work purely empirical. It was a matter of tinkering, the way a modern workman might repair an antique grandfather clock. You were dealing with something out of the past, something constructed of ancient materials and following ancient rules. You couldn't be certain why it worked as it did. And it had been repaired and modified many times already by forces of evolution over eons of time. So, like the workman who makes an adjustment and then sees if the clock runs any better, Wu would make an adjustment and then see if the animals behaved any better. And he only tried to correct gross behavior, uncontrolled butting of the electrical fences, or rubbing the skin raw on tree trunks. Those were the behaviors that sent him back to the drawing board. And the limits of his science had left him with a mysterious feeling about the dinosaurs in the park. He was never sure, never really sure at all, whether the behavior of the animals was historically accurate or not. Were they behaving as they really had in the past? It was an open question, ultimately unanswerable. And though Wu would never admit it, the discovery that the dinosaurs were breeding represented a tremendous validation of his work. A breeding animal was demonstrably effective in a fundamental way. It implied that Wu had put all the pieces together correctly. He had recreated an animal millions of years old with such precision that the creature could even reproduce itself. But still, looking at the raptors outside, he was troubled by the persistence of their behavior. Raptors were intelligent, and intelligent animals got bored quickly. Intelligent animals also formed plans, and... Harding came out into the hallway from Malcolm's room. "Where's Ellie?"
"Still outside. Better get her in. The raptors have left the skylight."
"When?" Wu said, moving to the door.
"Just a moment ago," Harding said.
Wu threw open the front door.
"Ellie! Inside! Now!"
She looked over at him, puzzled.
"There's no problem. Everything's under control. Now!"
She shook her head.
"I know what I'm doing," she said. "Now, Ellie, damn it!"
Muldoon didn't like Wu standing there with the door open, and he was about to say so when he saw a shadow descend from above, and he realized at once what had happened. Wu was yanked bodily out the door, and Muldoon heard Ellie screaming. Muldoon got to the door and looked out and saw that Wu was lying on his back, his body already torn open by the big claw, and the raptor was jerking its head, tugging at Wu's intestines, even though Wu was still alive, still feebly reaching up with his hands to push the big head away. He was being eaten while he was still alive. And then Ellie stopped screaming and started to run alongside the inside of the fence, and Muldoon slammed the door shut, dizzy with horror. It had happened so fast. Harding said, "He jumped down from the roof." Muldoon nodded. He went to the window and looked out, and he saw that the three raptors outside the fence were now running away. But they weren't following Ellie. They were going back, toward the visitor center. Grant came to the edge of the maintenance building and peered forward in the fog. He could hear the snarls of the raptors, and they seemed to be coming closer. Now he could see their bodies running past him. They were going to the visitor center. He looked back at Gennaro. Gennaro shook his head. "No." Grant leaned close and whispered in his ear, "No choice. We've got to turn on the computer." Grant set out in the fog. After a moment, Gennaro followed. Ellie didn't stop to think. When the raptors dropped inside the fence to attack Wu, she just turned and ran as fast as she could toward the far end of the lodge. There was a space 15 feet wide between the fence and the lodge. She ran, not hearing the animals pursuing her, just hearing her own breath. She rounded the corner, saw a tree growing by the side of the building, and leapt, grabbing a branch, swinging up. She didn't feel panic. She felt a kind of exhilaration as she kicked and saw her legs rise up in front of her face, and she hooked her legs over a branch farther up, tightened her gut, and pulled up quickly. She was already 12 feet off the ground, and the raptors still weren't following her, and she was beginning to feel pretty good when she saw the first animal at the base of the tree. Its mouth was bloody, and bits of stringy flesh hung from its jaws. She continued to go up fast, hand over hand, just reaching and going, and she could almost see the top of the building. She looked down again. The two raptors were climbing the tree. Now she was at the level of the rooftop. She could see the gravel only 4 feet away, and the glass pyramids of the skylight sticking up in the mist. There was a door on the roof. She could get inside. In a single heaving effort, she flung herself through the air and landed sprawling on the gravel. She scraped her face, but somehow the only sensation was exhilaration, as if it were a kind of game she was playing, a game she intended to win. She ran for the door that led to the stairwell. Behind her, she could hear the raptors shaking the branches of the tree. They were still in the tree. She reached the door and twisted the knob. The door was locked. It took a moment for the meaning of that to cut through her euphoria. The door was locked. She was on the roof, and she couldn't get down. The door was locked. She pounded on the door in frustration, and then she ran for the far side of the roof, hoping to see a way down. But there was only the green outline of the swimming pool through the blowing mist. All around the pool was concrete decking. 10, 12 feet of concrete, too much for her to jump across. No other trees to climb down, no stairs, no fire escape, nothing. Ellie turned back and saw the raptors jumping easily to the roof. She ran to the far end of the building, hoping there might be another door there. But there wasn't. The raptors came slowly toward her, stalking her, slipping silently among the glass pyramids. She looked down. The edge of the pool was 10 feet away, too far. The raptors were closer, starting to move apart. And illogically, she thought, isn't this always the way? Some little mistake screws it all up. She still felt giddy, still felt exhilaration. And she somehow couldn't believe these animals were going to get her. She couldn't believe that now her life was going to end like this. It didn't seem possible. She was enveloped in a kind of protective cheerfulness. She just didn't believe it would happen. The raptors snarled. Ellie backed away, moving to the far end of the roof. She took a breath, and then began to sprint toward the edge. As she raced toward the edge, she saw the swimming pool, and she knew it was too far away, but she thought, what the hell? And leapt into space, and fell. And with a stinging shock, she felt herself enveloped in coldness. She was underwater. She had done it. She came to the surface and looked up at the roof, and saw the raptors looking down at her, and she knew that if she could do it, the raptors could do it too. She splashed in the water and thought, can raptors swim? But she was sure they could. They could probably swim like crocodiles. The raptors turned away from the edge of the roof. And then she heard Harding calling, Sattler! And she realized he had opened the roof door. The raptors were going toward him. Hurriedly, she climbed out of the pool and ran toward the lodge. Harding had gone up the steps to the roof two at a time, and he had flung open the door without thinking. Sattler! He shouted, and then he stopped. Mist blew among the pyramids on the roof. The raptors were not in sight. Sattler! He was so preoccupied with Sattler that it was a moment before he realized his mistake. He should be able to see the animals, he thought. In the next instant, the clawed forearm smashed around the side of the door, catching him in the chest with a tearing pain, and it took all of his effort to pull himself backward and close the door on the arm, and from downstairs he heard Muldoon shouting, She's here! She's already inside! From the other side of the door, the raptor snarled, and Harding slammed the door again, and the claws pulled back, and he closed the door with a metallic clang, and sank, coughing, to the floor.
Where are we going?
Lex said. They were on the second floor of the visitor center. A glass-walled corridor ran the length of the building.
To the control room, Tim said. Where's that? Down here someplace.
Tim looked at the names stenciled on the doors as he went past them. These seemed to be offices. Park warden, guest services, general manager, controller. They came to a glass partition marked with a sign, Closed Area, Authorized Personnel Only, beyond this point. There was a slot for a security card, but Tim just pushed the door open.
How come it opened?
The power is out, Tim said.
Why are we going to the control room, she asked, to find a radio? We need to call somebody.
Beyond the glass door, the hallway continued. Tim remembered this area. He had seen it earlier during the tour. Lex trotted along at his side. In the distance, he heard the snarling of raptors. The animals seemed to be approaching. Then Tim heard them slamming against the glass downstairs.
They're out there,
Lex whispered. Don't worry.
What are they doing here?
Lex said.
Never mind now.
Park supervisor, operations, main control. Here, Tim said. He pushed open the door. The main control room was as he had seen it before. In the center of the room was a console with four chairs and four computer monitors. The room was entirely dark, except for the monitors, which all showed a series of colored rectangles.
So where's a radio?
Lex said. But Tim had forgotten all about a radio. He moved forward, staring at the computer screens. The screens were on. That could only mean
the power must be back on.
Ick! Lex said, shifting her body.
What? I was standing on somebody's ear,
she said. Tim hadn't seen a body when they came in. He looked back and saw there was just an ear lying on the floor.
That is really disgusting,
Lex said. Never mind. He turned to the monitors.
Where's the rest of him, she said. Never mind that now.
He peered closely at the monitor. There were rows of colored labels on the screen under the heading Jurassic Park System Startup.
You better not fool around with that, Timmy, she said.
Don't worry, I won't. He had seen complicated computers before, like the ones that were installed in the buildings his father worked on. Those computers controlled everything from the elevators and security to the heating and cooling systems. They looked basically like this, a lot of colored labels, but they were usually simpler to understand, and almost always there was a help label if you needed to learn about the system, but he saw no help label here. He looked again to be sure, but then he saw something else, numerals clicking in the upper left corner of the screen. They read 10, 47, 22. Then Tim realized it was the time. There were only 13 minutes left for the boat, but he was more worried about the people in the lodge. There was a static crackle. He turned and saw Lex holding a radio. She was twisting the knobs and dials.
How does it work? She said. I can't make it work.
Give me that.
It's mine. I found it. Give it to me, Lex. I get to use it first. Lex!
Suddenly the radio crackled.
What the hell is going on?
Said Muldoon's voice. Surprised, Lex dropped the radio on the floor. Grant ducked back, crouching among the palm trees. Through the mist ahead, he could see the raptors hopping and snarling and butting their heads against the glass of the visitor center. But between snarls, they would fall silent and cock their heads as if listening to something distant. And then they would make little whimpering sounds.
What are they doing?
Gennaro said. Looks like they're trying to get into the cafeteria, Grant said.
What's in the cafeteria?
I left the kids there, Grant said.
Can they break through that glass?
I don't think so, no. Grant watched, and now he heard the crackle of a distant radio, and the raptors began hopping in a more agitated way. One after another, they began jumping higher and higher, until finally he saw the first of them leap lightly onto the second-floor balcony, and from there move inside the second floor of the visitor center. In the control room on the second floor, Tim snatched up the radio which Lex had dropped. He pressed the button.
Hello? Hello?
Is that you, Tim?
It was Muldoon's voice.
It's me, yes.
Where are you?
In the control room. The power is on.
That's great, Tim,
Muldoon said.
If someone will tell me how to turn the computer on, I'll do it.
There was a silence.
Hello?
Tim said.
Did you hear me?
We have a problem about that, Muldoon said. Nobody, who is here knows how to do that, how to turn the computer on.
Tim said,
What, are you kidding? Nobody knows?
It seemed incredible.
No.
A pause.
I think it's something about the main grid, turning on the main grid. You know anything about computers, Tim?
Tim stared at the screen. Lex nudged him.
Tell him no, Timmy, she said. Yes, some. I know something, Tim said.
Might as well try, Muldoon said. Nobody here knows what to do, and Grant doesn't know about computers.
Okay, Tim said, I'll try. He clicked off the radio and stared at the screen, studying it.
Timmy,
Lex said,
you don't know what to do.
Yes, I do.
If you know, then do it,
Lex said. Just a minute. As a way to get started, he pulled the chair close to the keyboard and pressed the cursor keys. Those were the keys that moved the cursor around on the screen. But nothing happened. Then he pushed other keys. The screen remained unchanged.
Well, she said. Something's wrong, Tim said, frowning. You just don't know, Timmy, she said.
He examined the computer again, looking at it carefully. The keyboard had a row of function keys at the top, just like a regular PC keyboard, and the monitor was big and in color, but the monitor housing was sort of unusual. Tim looked at the edges of the screen and saw lots of faint pinpoints of red light.
Red light all around the borders of the screen. What could that be?
He moved his finger toward the light and saw the soft red glow on his skin. He touched the screen where it said Access TNL and heard a beep. A message box flashed up saying, You already have access. Make your selection from the main screen. A moment later, the message box disappeared and the original screen flashed back up.
What happened? Lex said. What did you do? You touched something.
Of course, he thought. He had touched the screen. It was a touch screen. The red lights around the edges must be infrared sensors. Tim had never seen such a screen, but he'd read about them in magazines. He touched Reset Revert. Instantly the screen changed. He got a new message. The computer is now reset. Make your selection from the main screen. Over the radio, they heard the sound of raptors snarling.
I want to see, Lex said. You should try view.
No, Lex.
Well, I want view, she said,
and before he could grab her hand, she had pressed view. The screen changed. Now the heading at the top said Subroutines View, Video Interface Environmental Watch. Other labeled boxes arrayed underneath designated video monitors at various locations in the park.
Uh-oh, she said. Lex, will you cut it out? Look, she said. It worked. Ha!
Around the room, the monitors showed quickly changing views of different parts of the park. Most of the images were misty gray because of the exterior fog, but one showed the outside of the lodge with a raptor on the roof, and then another switched to an image in bright sunlight showing the bow of a ship. Bright sunlight.
What was that? Tim said, leaning forward. What? That picture?
But the image had already changed, and now they were seeing the inside of the lodge, one room after another, and then he saw Malcolm lying in a bed.
Stop it, Lex said. I see them.
Tim touched the screen in several places and got submenus, then more submenus.
Wait, Lex said, you're confusing it. Will you shut up? You don't know anything about computers.
Now he had a list of monitors on the screen. One of them was marked Safari Lodge, LV2-4. Another was Remote Shipboard, VND. He pressed the screen several times. Video images came up on monitors around the room. One showed the bow of the supply ship and the ocean ahead. In the distance, Tim saw land, buildings along a shore, and a harbor. He recognized the harbor because he had flown over it in a helicopter the day before. It was Punta Arenas. The ship seemed to be just minutes from landing. But his attention was drawn by the next screen, which showed the roof of the safari lodge in gray mist. The raptors were mostly hidden behind the pyramids, but their heads bobbed up and down, coming into view. And then on the third monitor, he could see inside a room. Malcolm was lying in a bed, and Ellie stood next to him. They were both looking upward. As they watched, Muldoon walked into the room and joined them, looking up with an expression of concern.
They see us, Lex said. I don't think so.
The radio crackled. On the screen, Muldoon lifted the radio to his lips.
Hello, Tim?
I'm here, Tim said.
We haven't got a whole lot of time, Muldoon said dully. Better get that power grid on.
And then Tim heard the raptors snarl and saw one of the long heads duck down through the glass, briefly entering the picture from the top, snapping its jaws.
Hurry, Timmy, Lex said. Get the power on!
The Grid. Tim suddenly found himself lost in a tangled series of monitor control screens as he tried to get back to the main screen. Most systems had a single button or a single command to return to the previous screen or to the main menu, but this system did not, or at least he didn't know it. Also, he was certain that help commands had been built into the system, but he couldn't find them either. And Lex was jumping up and down and shouting in his ear, making him nervous. Finally, he got the main screen back. He wasn't sure what he had done, but it was back. He paused, looking for a command.
Do something, Timmy! Will you shut up? I'm trying to get help.
He pushed template, main. The screen filled with a complicated diagram with interconnecting boxes and arrows. No good, no good. He pushed common interface. The screen shifted. Now the heading at the top said common interface with tiers of different labeled boxes underneath.
What's that? Lex said. Why aren't you turning on the power, Timmy?
He ignored her. Maybe help on this system was called info. He pushed info, and a message box appeared. Jurassic Park Common User Interface version 1.1B24. Developed by Integrated Computer Systems Incorporated, Cambridge, Mass. Project Supervisor, Dennis Nedry. Chief Programmer, Mike Bax. Jurassic Park Incorporated, all rights reserved.
Timmy!
Lex wailed, but he'd already pushed find. He got another useless window. He pushed go back, and the screen flashed up another message window. Jurassic Park Common User Interface. Command go back. Cannot go back without a specific search option. See also search, change, go ahead, find, options, review. On the radio, he heard Muldoon say,
"How's it coming, Tim?"
He didn't bother to answer. Frantic, he pushed buttons one after another. Suddenly, without warning, the main screen was back. Jurassic Park System Startup. And below it, a score of labeled boxes. He studied the screen. Electrical Main and Set Grids DNL both looked like they might have something to do with the grids. He noticed that Safety Stroke Health and Critical Locks might be important, too. He heard the growl of the raptors. He had to make a choice. He pressed Set Grids DNL and groaned when he saw the resulting readout. Rows of labeled boxes and figures under two main box headings, Custom Parameters and Standard Parameters. He didn't know what to do. He pushed Standard Parameters and got another screen. Standard Parameters, Park Grids, B4-C6. Outer Grids, C2-D2. Zoological Grids, BB-07. Pen Grids, R4-R4, Lodge Grids, F4-D4, Maint Grids, E5-L6, Main Grids, C4-G7, Sensor Grids, D5-G4, Utility Grids, AH-B5, Core Grids, A1-C1, Circuit Integrity Not Tested, Security Grids Remain Automatic. Tim shook his head in frustration. It took him a moment to realize that he had just gotten valuable information. He now knew the grid coordinates for the lodge. He pushed grid F4, and the screen flashed, Power Grid F4, Safari Lodge. Command cannot be executed. Error-505. Power incompatible with command error. Refer manual pages 4.09 to 4.11.
It's not working, Lex said.
I know. He pushed another button. The screen flashed again. Power Grid D4, Safari Lodge. Command cannot be executed. Error-505. Power incompatible with command error. Refer manual pages 4.09 to 4.11. Tim tried to stay calm, to think it through. For some reason, he was getting a consistent error message whenever he tried to turn on a grid. It was saying the power was incompatible with the command he was giving. But what did that mean? Why was power incompatible?
Timmy,
Lex said, tugging at his arm.
Not now, Lex. Yes, now, she said,
and she pulled him away from the screen and the console, and then he heard the snarling of raptors. It was coming from the hallway. In the skylight above Malcolm's bed, the raptors had almost bitten through the second metal bar. They could now poke their heads entirely through the shattered glass and lunge and snarl at the people below. Then after a moment they would pull back and resume chewing on the metal. Malcolm said,
It won't be long now. 3-4 minutes.
He pressed the button on the radio.
Tim, are you there? Tim?
There was no answer. Tim slipped out the door and saw the velociraptor down at the far end of the corridor, standing by the balcony. He stared in astonishment. How had it gotten out of the freezer? Then as he watched, a second raptor suddenly appeared on the balcony, and he understood. The raptor hadn't come from the freezer at all. It had come from outside. It had jumped from the ground below. The second raptor landed silently, perfectly balanced on the railing. Tim couldn't believe it. The big animal had jumped 10 feet straight up. More than 10 feet. Their legs must be incredibly powerful. Lex whispered,
I thought you said they couldn't...
Shh! Tim was trying to think. But he watched with a kind of fascinated dread as the third raptor leapt to the balcony. The animals milled aimlessly in the corridor for a moment, and then they began to move forward in single file, coming toward him and Lex. Quietly, Tim pushed against the door at his back to re-enter the control room, but the door was stuck. He pushed harder.
We're locked out,
Lex whispered.
Look!
She pointed to the slot for the security card alongside the door. A bright red dot glowed. Somehow the security doors had been activated.
You idiot, you locked us out!
Tim looked down the corridor. He saw several more doors, but each had a red light glowing alongside. That meant all the doors were locked. There was nowhere they could go. Then he saw a slumped shape on the floor at the far end of the corridor. It was a dead guard. A white security card was clipped to his belt. Come on, he whispered. They ran for the guard. Tim got the card and turned back, but of course the raptors had seen them. They snarled and blocked the way back to the control room. They began to spread out, fanning out in the hallway to surround Tim and Lex. Their heads began to duck rhythmically. They were going to attack. Tim did the only thing he could do. Using the card, he opened the nearest door off the hallway and pushed Lex through. As the door began to close slowly behind them, the raptors hissed and charged. Lodge. Ian Malcolm drew each breath as if it might be his last. He watched the raptors with dull eyes. Harding took his blood pressure, frowned, took it again. Ellie Sattler was wrapped in a blanket, shivering and cold. Muldoon sat on the floor, propped against the wall. Hammond was staring upward, not speaking. They all listened to the radio.
What happened to Tim?
Hammond said.
Still no word?
I don't know.
Malcolm said,
ugly, aren't they? Truly ugly.
Hammond shook his head.
Who could have imagined it would turn out this way?
Ellie said,
apparently Malcolm did.
I didn't imagine it, Malcolm said. I calculated it.
Hammond sighed.
No more of this, please. He's been saying I told you so for hours, but nobody wanted this to happen. It isn't a matter of wanting it or not,
Malcolm said, eyes closed. He spoke slowly through the drugs.
It's a matter of what you think you can accomplish. When the hunter goes out in the rainforest to seek food for his family, does he expect to control nature? No. He imagines that nature is beyond him, beyond his understanding, beyond his control. Maybe he prays to nature, to the fertility of the forest that provides for him. He prays because he knows he doesn't control it. He's at the mercy of it. But you decide you won't be at the mercy of nature. You decide you'll control nature. And from that moment on, you're in deep trouble because you can't do it. Yet you have made systems that require you to do it. And you can't do it. And you never have. And you never will. Don't confuse things. You can make a boat, but you can't make the ocean. You can make an airplane, but you can't make the air. Your powers are much less than your dreams of reason would have you believe.
He's lost me, Hammond said with a sigh.
Where did Tim go? He seems such a responsible boy.
I'm sure he's trying to get control of the situation, Malcolm said, like everybody else.
And Grant, too. What happened to Grant?
Grant reached the rear door to the visitor center, the same door he had left 20 minutes before. He tugged on the handle. It was locked. Then he saw the little red light. The security doors were reactivated. Damn! He ran around to the front of the building and went through the shattered front doors into the main lobby, stopping by the guard desk where he had been earlier. He could hear the dry hiss of his radio. He went to the kitchen, looking for the kids,
but the kitchen door was open, the kids gone. He went upstairs, but came to the glass panel marked closed area, and the door was locked. He needed a security card to go farther. Grant couldn't get in. From somewhere inside the hallway, he heard the raptors snarling. The leathery reptile's skin touched Tim's face. The claws tore his shirt, and Tim fell onto his back, shrieking in fright. "Timmy!" Lex yelled. Tim scrambled to his feet again. The baby velociraptor perched on his shoulder, chirping and squeaking in panic. Tim and Lex were in the white nursery. There were toys on the floor, a rolling yellow ball, a doll, a plastic rattle.
"It's the baby raptor,"
Lex said, pointing to the animal gripping Tim's shoulder. The little raptor burrowed its head into Tim's neck. The poor thing was probably starving, Tim thought. Lex came closer, and the baby hopped onto her shoulder. It rubbed against her neck.
"Why is it doing that?" she said. "Is it scared?"
"I don't know," Tim said. She passed the raptor back to Tim. The baby was chirping and squeaking and hopping up and down on his shoulder excitedly. It kept looking around, head moving quickly. No doubt about it, the little thing was worked up and...
"Tim!"
Lex whispered. The door to the hallway hadn't closed behind them after they had entered the nursery. Now the big velociraptors were coming through, first one, then a second one. Clearly agitated, the baby chirped and bounced on Tim's shoulder. Tim knew he had to get away. Maybe the baby would distract them. After all, it was a baby raptor. He plucked the little animal from his shoulder and threw it across the room. The baby scurried between the legs of the adults. The first raptor lowered its snout, sniffed at the baby delicately. Tim took Lex's hand and pulled her deeper into the nursery. He had to find a door, a way to get out. There was a high, piercing shriek. Tim looked back to see the baby in the jaws of the adult. A second velociraptor came forward and tore at the limbs of the infant, trying to pull it from the mouth of the first. The two raptors fought over the baby as it squealed. Blood splattered in large drops onto the floor.
"They ate him," Lex said.
The raptors fought over the remains of the baby, rearing back and butting heads. Tim found a door. It was unlocked, and went through, pulling Lex after him. They were in another room, and from the deep green glow, he realized it was a deserted DNA extraction laboratory, the rows of stereo microscopes abandoned, the high-resolution screens showing frozen, giant, black-and-white images of insects. The flies and gnats that had bitten dinosaurs millions of years ago, sucking the blood that now had been used to recreate dinosaurs in the park. They ran through the laboratory, and Tim could hear the snorts and snarls of the raptors pursuing them, coming closer. And then he went to the back of the lab and through a door that must have had an alarm, because in the narrow corridor an intermittent siren sounded shrilly, and the lights overhead flashed on and off. Running down the corridor, Tim was plunged into darkness, then light again, then darkness. Over the sound of the alarm, he heard the raptors snort as they pursued him. Lex was whimpering and moaning. Tim saw another door ahead, with a blue biohazard sign, and he slammed into the door and moved beyond it. And suddenly he collided with something big, and Lex shrieked in terror. "Take it easy, kids," a voice said. Tim blinked in disbelief. Standing above him was Dr. Grant, and next to him was Mr. Gennaro. Outside in the hallway, it had taken Grant nearly 2 minutes to realize that the dead guard down in the lobby probably had a security card. He'd gone back and gotten it, and entered the upper corridor, moving quickly down the hallway. He had followed the sound of the raptors and found them fighting in the nursery. He was sure the kids would have gone to the next room and had immediately run to the extractions lab, and there he'd met the kids. Now the raptors were coming toward them. The animals seemed momentarily hesitant, surprised by the appearance of more people. Grant pushed the kids into Gennaro's arms and said, "Take them back someplace safe, but through there," Grant said, pointing over his shoulder to a far door. "Take them to the control room if you can. You should all be safe there." "What are you going to do?" Gennaro said. The raptors stood near the door. Grant noticed that they waited until all the animals were together, and then they moved forward as a group, pack hunters. He shivered. "I have a plan," Grant said. "Now go on." Gennaro led the kids away. The raptors continued slowly toward Grant, moving past the supercomputers, past the screens that still blinked endless sequences of computer-deciphered code. The raptors came forward without hesitation, sniffing the floor, repeatedly ducking their heads.
Grant heard the door click behind him and glanced over his shoulder. Everybody was standing on the other side of the glass door watching him. Gennaro shook his head. Grant knew what it meant. There was no door to the control room beyond. Gennaro and the kids were trapped in there. It was up to him now. Grant moved slowly, edging around the